there are usages which probably make sense for the stablecoins, but let's at least make sure that we know what's going on there, that we have a good sense of the amounts at play, that we have a good sense of the guarantees of the state of the reserves, and that we know in real time exactly who supervises what. And this is what is missing at the moment.
A radical macroeconomic experiment is taking place in the US at exactly the time its external financial position is showing signs of stress. My guest today asks, what are the risks of stablecoins for the US and for Europe? Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Center for Economic Policy Research. I'm Tim Phillips. The fourth Paris report from CEPR and Bruegel is called The New Global Imbalances. In a high debt and fragmented world, excess savings, rising surpluses, and rising deficits pose a risk to stability and undermine the global trading system. A very new financial instrument, stablecoins, may be key to resolving how the US funds its deficits. Gilles Moek, chief economist at AXA, has written a chapter for the report on what stablecoins are, why they may be useful to the US at this moment, but the risks they might also pose to the financial system both in the US and in Europe. When we met, I first asked him to explain the role of stablecoins for those of us who are still trying to catch up.
So if you want to define it very, very quickly, it's a digital means of payment. You usually use the word token for this kind of stuff. Since it is digital, it settles almost immediately. It can be used 24 hours, 7. And it has all the nice, you know, frills that come with the digital currency programmability. For instance, you can order it to do stuff in the future. And where it differs from the usual cryptos, the usual digital currency, is that it is or should be more stable, hence the word stablecoin. Why? Mm-hmm. Because it is backed by assets which are considered to be safe and liquid, so that its value is strictly correlated with a currency, an existing fiat currency. So basically, a $1 stablecoin will always be worth $1, or at least it's what is written on the tin. So it's a digital currency. It is not issued by a central bank. It's issued by a private platform. So this is where, for instance, it differs from a central bank digital currency. But relative to all the cryptos that you can find around, also issued by private platforms, it is supposed to be completely safe in terms of its exchange rate with fiat currencies.
We're talking about global imbalances in this series of podcasts, and the numbers are huge. They are massive, especially when we're talking about the US debt, something we're going to be talking about today. How big is the stablecoin market at the moment in comparison?
No, for now, it is not major. We're talking about a fast-growing asset, but the latest data we have on stablecoins would tell you there's probably still a bit under $300 billion. The growth rate is massive. It was basically non-existent just a few years ago, but today it is fairly small. Now, what we can see is that in terms of moving some segments of the traditional markets, it is already relevant. There is, for instance, a paper by the Bank for International Settlements, which tell us that when the stablecoin platforms invest in their reserves, because those reserves are what backs the value of those stablecoins, it can already have some visible impact on short-term interest rates in the US. And in terms of the size of it, if you want to measure it, at times it may have absorbed. It's a bit complicated to calculate it because there is not a lot of actual data on this, but probably up to 20-25% of the net issuance of T-bills, so short-dated US debt securities, roughly, yeah, one-fifth, one-fourth of that has probably been absorbed by stablecoins.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of two podcasts we're publishing today to mark the launch of the Paris Report. Also, check out our conversation with Maurice Obstfeld of the Peterson Institute on how previous episodes of Global Imbalances have ended and whether today's policymakers have learned their lessons. And go to Bruegel's podcast, The Sound of Economics, to find an interview with two of the report's editors, Beatrice Vega de Mauro, president of CUPR, and Geraldine Zechelmeyer, director of Bruegel, about the problem of global imbalances.
So I'm an investor. Imagine I'm an investor, either outside the US, as I am, or domestic. How do stable coins function for me if I want to invest in them?
Well, for the time being, or at least until very recently, it was mostly a form of currency which was used within the digital ecosphere. So it was, for instance, used as collateral. It was used as means of settlement within, actually, the digital currency framework. There was not a lot of usage, if you want, of stablecoins in the sort of traditional financial sphere. Mm-hmm. But this is where things could change because, as you know, the US government is quite supportive of the asset and they wanted to become a much more run-of-the-mill means of payment, which could be used also for all sorts of, you know, traditional financial relationships where, for instance, it could be used quite easily and where you could see why it would be attractive. It's on big cross-border payments. Using stablecoins could be quite attractive for companies, for instance, faced with major cross-border payments.
The assets that back stablecoins, they are government debt, aren't they? So if I'm investing a dollar in stablecoins, am I effectively investing a dollar in US government debt?
Yes, you don't know it, but actually it is what you do. But what you're doing at the same time is that you are forfeiting the interest rate, which is normally coming with investing in US government security. So
yeah.
The Genius Act, which is, you know, the new regulation in the US, which is supposed to organize the market, tell us that reserves of stablecoins need to be supported back-to-back by highly liquid assets. And in most cases, in the current platforms that are already operating, the most frequent form of safe and liquid asset which is used is US government T-bills. T-bills with maturity, of up to 3 months in general. You exchange your hard-earned cash, normal, fiat, usual, traditional, old-style cash, for a token. And the cash that you've transferred to the platform is being invested in those liquid safe assets. And the platforms keep the interest rate for themselves. And it's actually how they operate. I don't think it is surprising to see that the big increase, the big, you know, emergence in stablecoins dates back from the moment interest rates in the US started raising again. If you have a 3 month US Treasury bill paying you 4%, and this is effectively backing tokens paying zero interest rate. And actually by law in the US, it is actually prohibited to pay interest on those stablecoins. You make a very, very decent margin without too much actually of an effort. So you are not holding directly a US government security when you hold a token. That is something we have to remember.
Yeah.
What you hold is a liability of a platform, which itself has invested in government securities. So yes, down the road, what you are actually holding is backed by government securities, but you don't get the interest rate and you don't have direct access to those securities. It all depends on how the platform itself is being regulated, is being supervised, so that you can be sure that should the need arise, yes, the platform will transform those government securities into hard cash and pay you back.
Now, Gilles, I know that you're not a financial advisor, but you do seem to know quite a lot about these things. Why, instead of having a dollar-denominated stablecoin, why do I not just buy dollars instead?
Because actually, it's not always that easy. And when you read the literature in the US government. Miran, for instance, who is now at the Fed and was at the White House and is a big proponent of stablecoins in the US government at the moment. What he says is that our target, that's the people in emerging countries, developing countries, where the local banking system is actually not necessarily up to scratch. There might be regulations actually prohibiting you from investing directly into foreign currencies. You don't trust that much your own financial system and your own currency. You don't have any easy, legit ways through your national system to access those dollars. So why not buy stable coins? That is the main target, actually, of the asset class at the moment. People who do not trust that much their own financial system and want exposure to a proper currency, so to speak.
So if the stablecoin market grows, does this mean that because of the T-bills that are being bought to back them, the US gets access to cheap borrowing?
Yes, and it's the main reason, actually, why I think people like, you know, Stephen Miran really support the idea. So the US situation at the moment is actually quite interesting. For years, there was a sort of paradox in the US external position. The US has a huge current account deficit. We all know that. And it's probably structural. It's been there for decades. But within this current account deficit, what was quite interesting is that they had structurally a positive income balance. So your trade balance is very, very negative. You buy much more stuff from the rest of the world than you sell to the rest of the world. On services, things have always been better for the US. But what always offset a part of their trade deficit is the fact that the balance of the income that they send to the rest of the world as payment on the US assets owned by foreign investors has always been lower than the income that Americans get from the rest of the world in payment, in return, of the foreign assets that those American investors actually hold. It's something which has been highlighted by Hélène Rey, Pierre Vigo and Chasse, for instance, in 2007. So basically what has been happening until very recently is that, yes, the US had a huge trade deficit, but their income position was actually quite positive because the rest of the world has always been happy to send a lot of their savings to the US, even when those savings were not very, very well remunerated and focusing on the risk-free assets, which come with low remuneration, whereas the Americans have always been very interested in investing in riskier but also more rewarding assets in the rest of the world. So you had this nice, a positive income balance. 2024, for the first time since we have modern data on balance of payments, the income balance fell into negative territory in the US. Mm-hmm. For the first time, they were actually paying more to the rest of the world than they were getting from the rest of the world. And in terms of financial income, there are lots of technical reasons why this happened, and it would take us 2 hours to get through all of them. But I think this is one of the reasons which put the US in a complicated position now. It's all very well when you say, okay, I've got a trade deficit, I'm trying to deal with it with tariffs. I don't think it will work, but you try to deal with it this way. But at least I've got this nice positive income position. If your income position gets negative, then there are more questions about the sustainability of your external position. And then you've got this great idea. Okay, so why not try to lure more foreign investors into a US asset which pays exactly zero, which is what stablecoins actually does.
Gilles, you parallel this with something that happened well before anyone had thought of stablecoins, which is the US National Banking Acts of 1863 and 1864. I was completely unfamiliar with these. What is the parallel here?
Okay, so in the US after the Civil War, actually in the middle of the Civil War, their financial system was in complete disarray. They had a huge public debt due to the defense spending. And they had this great idea of actually rationalizing the monetary system by setting up those national banks, which were private banks, which would issue banknotes, hence the name, by the way, banknotes to, you know, you and me. And those banknotes would be backed by US government debt, which is exactly
the same thing.
The same thing.
Yeah.
And this was a quite clever way to deal with the complete disorganization of the system in those days. So there were lots of, you know, regulatory safeguards, if you want. For instance, it was over-collateralized. What does this mean? It meant that when a national bank would issue $100 worth of banknotes to you and me, they would be forced to hold 110 of government bonds. They also had tons of systems to make sure that should a national bank default, there would be a recourse, a system where basically the US Treasury would take over and would make sure that the bearers of the banknotes issued by the defaulted credit institution could still get their money back directly from the government. So the system looked okay. One of the big problems is that when you do that, you create a situation where down the road, money creation, the amount of money that is in circulation in the economy, depends on the fluctuations in the quantum of public debt.
Mm-hmm.
And Milton Friedman, at the beginning of his big book, you know, Monetary History of the United States, wrote extensively on the national bank system. And as you know, one of the main points that Milton Friedman made in the late 60s, early 70s, is that you need to make sure that the quantity of money in circulation is to some extent consistent with the needs of the economy. If money creation goes too fast, you get inflation. If money creation is too slow, you get deflation, and you don't want that. So you want to create a system where money creation is constantly in line with the needs of the economy. It's easier said than done, but that's basically Friedman in 20 seconds for you. The problem with the national bank system is that ultimately, the quantum of money in circulation was dependent on the quantum of public debt.
Yeah.
And after the Civil War, the US government ran a pretty cautious fiscal policy. The deficits fell massively. And actually, there was just not enough public debt created to allow for the huge need in our currency that came with the strong economic development of the United States. The banks had other ways to create money because on top of the national bank system, you had something which looks like the current system where banks could create money, so to speak, out of thin air through the issuance of credit, but there were lots of limits there as well.
Mm-hmm.
So basically in 1913, the decision was made, you know, let's stop, let's move to the Federal Reserve System more or less in the way we know it today. But the national bank system survived, yeah, a good 50 years, but it came with all these deficiencies which I mentioned, and the fact in particular that potentially you create a sort of hiatus between the needs of the economy, the way the banking sector operates, and circulation of money. So if we would end up in a situation where stablecoins would become the dominant means of payments in dollars, that would probably trigger quite a lot of issues for the banking sector in the US and lots of issues with credit as well. Because it's something that is a bit, you know, maybe hard to explain or to justify because people are usually quite negative about the role of banks. But the very fact that banks create money by issuing credit to businesses and consumers, this is actually a fairly healthy way to make sure that money creation is more or less in line with the needs of the economy, because you need a demand for credit to get the right amount of money creation. Now, the way banks do it and why banks do it is that they constantly make an interesting margin between what they pay on deposits and what they're getting paid by extending credit. If they cannot create this margin because the people would move away from deposits into cryptos, into digital currencies, into stablecoins, then the credit creating machine can actually start stalling.
On the upside, if you're a US policymaker, if there is a dollar stablecoin system, is that securing the power of the dollar, something that we've all been speculating about internationally? Does it help to do that?
It does help to do that.
Uh-huh.
If it expands nicely, basically, it's a de-dollarization fighter. It's a big theme at the moment that people across the world are moving out of the dollar. You can see that, for instance, the payments that are extracted by Iran to cross the Strait of Hormuz, they want payments actually in anything but in dollars. So you can see this de-dollarization push coming through. But if you offer to the rest of the world, and again, especially in those developing emerging countries where people are not too sure about their own currencies, you offer easy access to the dollar, yes, you recreate actually a nice structural demand for dollars. The risk, however, that the US would take is that it's unclear whether they would have the same capacity of intervention, the same capacity to regulate, to intervene with stuff like stablecoins than what they have with the traditional dollar. One thing to keep in mind, for instance, is that one of the two biggest platforms currently offering stablecoins is incorporated in Salvador.
Right.
Which probably doesn't make it very easy for US institutions to actually regulate and look into what's going on there.
Yes. You mentioned that it works against this fear of de-dollarization. If you look at it from the other end of the telescope, from those economies, or even from the UK, is this a sort of a backdoor dollarization of other economies?
Honestly, I don't think that more developed economies, more mature economies are that much at risk. Because, yeah, there is this attraction in terms of cross-border payments for big institutions, for multinational companies that might actually trigger some push towards stablecoins and the dollar. But I don't think the general public is going to be that interested, actually, in those solutions because our traditional currencies are actually quite solid. And you can have access in most developed markets to traditional dollar-denominated assets. One thing which runs against the development of stablecoins, especially in mature economies, is the very fact that they don't pay interest rate. If what you are trying to protect yourselves against is, okay, my currency is not great, my financial system is not great, I want to have access to dollars. I don't really care if that pays interest rate or not. You're probably happy to forfeit that. Now, if you operate in a developed economy with, you know, a normal, fully functioning financial system, why would you forfeit interest rates by moving into stablecoins? Where things actually can get interesting is that, you know, monetary innovation has no limits. So what is currently also emerging, it's digital money market funds, which would operate from a technical point of view, if you want, exactly like a stablecoin, but they would pay you interest.
We are getting back to the world as it was, but via a stablecoin route, there is at the moment some regulation around stablecoins. But if we're thinking about international holdings of stablecoins, this is something that Richard Portes spoke to me about a few months ago. There are worries, aren't there, that there is a sort of a regulatory hole here that appetite for stablecoins might put international investors in a regulatory problem if something bad happened.
Yeah, because, you know, there's the multi-currency, for instance, issuance. You could end up with European platforms, for instance, set up in Europe where regulation tends to be tougher, where investors from the rest of the world would actually ask for, you know, a proper, so to speak, repatriation of the hard-earned dollars from European platforms rather than from US platforms, which could put them in a complicated situation. But more generally, I think the issue there is that we don't know how effective and stringent the US regulation is going to be. And it's the US regulation which really matters because at the moment, it's about 99% of stablecoins which have been issued in dollars. The Genius Act, on paper, looks pretty reasonable in terms of, you know, what they ask from the platforms, in terms of, you know, diversification, in terms of, you know, reserve backing and so forth. There are quite a few problems, though. First of all, there is a grace period of about 3 years while actually the details of regulations are being sorted out, where platforms can continue to operate the way they have.
Three years. And second,
you've got this, the Genius Act is a framework, but it doesn't really get into details. And for instance, very often in the text, if you read it, it's not for the faint-hearted, but very often what comes in the text is federal or state regulators are invited to propose their supervision rules. For instance, on, you know, the basic compliance rules on know your customer, et cetera, et cetera. So they're invited to provide regulation, but there is at the moment no hard regulation, no hard supervision on the way they operate. Finally, there's another thing. The US is a federal country. So if you are a small platform, you're not going to be necessarily regulated by the federal government. You're going to be regulated by your state. And as often in those cases, there's quite a bit of regulatory competition across the states to try to attract as many platforms as possible. There's a safeguard in the Genius Act, which would create common basic benchmarks across the states to make sure that their regulation is not abused. But it's going to be quite a long process, I think, before we know exactly what is the stringency of the system in the US. In Europe, we've done a bit the opposite. We've got MiCA. The regulation is already there. It's actually quite stringent. It's actually quite precise. But we don't really have stablecoin platforms. Now, we did the European thing, which is to let's regulate first and let's see if something actually emerges. But it's also an issue for the Americans. That's a point I make in the chapter, which is, I think even within the current US government, there is some concern about the possibility that stablecoins could be abused against the interests of the United States. There's quite an interesting issue, which is around exchange of information. Mm-hmm. As is well known, the US government has refused to participate to the OECD-led general framework for exchange of financial information. So the world needs to abide by the US regulation. And it's very precise, and they really want to know who does what the minute you actually touch dollars. But the reverse is not true. The US does not send a lot of information to the rest of the world. Interestingly, they've been more open to the possibility that there would be some international cooperation on the exchange of information on digital currencies, including stablecoins. Why? Because they can see for themselves that if it's loosely regulated, even in the US and even by US entities, it may be abused and it may end up with, you know, tax evasion, for instance, or it could put their own financial system at risk. So this is where there might be actually some capacity to work with America, because it's in everyone's interest that there is at least a proper knowledge of what's going on there. My view on this is that we should not ban it outright. No, there's no reason to ban this outright. Yeah, why not? There are usages which probably make sense for the stablecoins, but let's at least make sure that we know what's going on there, that we have a good sense of the amounts at play, that we have a good sense of the guarantees of the state of the reserves, and that we know in real time exactly who supervises what. And this is what is missing at the moment.
So to sum up, Gilles, given the short-term advantages of promoting stablecoins for the US government, despite these risks, do you consider that the stablecoin is here to stay as a financial instrument?
I think there is a good case, actually, in the sense that we've seen the development of digital currencies. The technological advantages are there. They're obvious. Speed of settlement, the fact that it's, you know, open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, that you can program it. I mean, this is proper, interesting innovation, and we should never forget that the financial system is expensive. People forget about that. No, but yeah, it costs you a bit of money to move cash around. Just think of what you pay on your debit card, for instance. So it's an interesting technological innovation. It comes with risks. It comes with risks in terms, for instance, of depriving emerging or developing countries from the chance to actually really set up their own financial system. You know, if the entirety of the liquidity of a country is sucked into this sort of US-denominated assets, they will never have a chance to develop their own system. So there are lots of risks. But yeah, it's probably here to stay. But as I said, innovation in monetary matters never stops. So the stablecoins, their main issue, I think, again, for investors in developed nations, is the fact that it doesn't pay interest rate. So what you could get is the development of a digital money market funds. And then the issue becomes slightly different. It could come with extremely low fees and ease of use, which could become an issue for banks, because it would create additional competition for the term deposits that they offer. It could be also competition for traditional asset managers, because why would people invest in fairly high fee forms of liquid funds if actually they can simply invest in almost zero fee money market funds. So I don't think it will stop here. This is something that is going to shape the financial industry in the years ahead, and which will have a bearing also on global imbalances for a long time, because whoever manages to secure a good chunk of international liquidity obviously will be in a better position to deal with their internal imbalances. It's here to stay.
And this is just the beginning of the story. Gilles, thank you very much for talking about it.
Most welcome.
We have been talking about Paris Report number 4, titled The New Global Imbalances. It was edited by Helene Ray, Beatrice Veda Di Mauro, and Jeremy Zettelmeyer. The report is a free download at cepr.org.
Vox Talks Economics is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber. And our editor is Andrei Zagarian.